Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, President Obama said the U.S. would begin to bring the Iraq War to a close.
I made it clear that by August 31st, 2010, America's combat mission in Iraq would end. And that is exactly what we are doing, as promised and on schedule.
Today, as the U.S. draws down, we're taking a long look at the meaning of that mission, the sacrifice, the deep wounds, the stories. This hour on Point, Iraq up close as the big U.S. pullout gets serious. You can join the conversation. How do you see the Iraq War as the U.S. draws down its commitment? What do we owe Iraqis and the U.S. troops who sacrificed? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear in a moment from two prominent storytellers of the Iraq War, writer David Finkel and soldier Matt Gallagher. But joining me first from Baghdad is Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. His latest book is Night Draws Near. Anthony, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
As America prepares to draw down troops, how would you describe, Anthony, the condition of the Iraqi government?
Well, it's a prolonged political stalemate that we have in Iraq these days. Iraqis went to the polls about 5 months ago, and since then there's been pretty much paralysis. The four main factions that succeeded in those elections have yet to agree on hardly anything. And there's a deep sense here, that this stalemate could go on weeks, even months more. The effect of that is that we don't have a government in Iraq right now. There hasn't been a law passed in months, and there's definitely a sense of anxiety and unease about what that means for the future.
All right, and so then what about security? If there's a political stalemate, how is security in Baghdad and throughout Iraq?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the morning after President Obama spoke of bringing the war to a responsible end, you had insurgents overrunning a checkpoint in Baghdad, killing five people and raising their black banner. There were three mortars crashing into Baghdad, five roadside bombs, two cars were booby-trapped, another two mortars fell into the green zone. And, the sad fact is that that's not all that violent of a day for Baghdad. So I think the idea of the war ending is an elastic term or an elastic phrase. The war may be ending for America in some respects as the withdrawal begins, and even that withdrawal is, still a very prolonged thing. For Iraqis, I think the war is still very much going on. If we don't call it a war, we can call it a sense of instability, of unease, of anxiety, and violence still very much colors Iraqis' lives.
So they're feeling very uneasy, Iraqis, generally, about American troops departing.
Well, I think it's a mixed thing there. You often have conflicting sentiments when you ask people or when you talk to people about an American withdrawal. To be honest, most people don't think the Americans are withdrawing. They think that there will be an American presence here in some form far down the road, that agreements will be renegotiated, that there will still be bases here. Some people worry if they actually do withdraw, it'll be more violent here. Some are bitter about their presence in the first place. So you often have very conflicting sentiments, sometimes spoken by the same person. I think it's reflective in a sense of how much has happened here, how confusing the landscape remains.
What are the logistics, Anthony, for the American military at this moment as it goes from 3.4 million pieces of equipment, 357 bases, 144,000 soldiers, as everybody departs and people leave and equipment goes? Are there long convoys back to Kuwait? Are entire cities being evacuated? I mean, what are the logistics of this?
Well, it's a vast logistical operation, and although you don't see all that much of the withdrawal in the cities themselves, the Americans, of course, ostensibly withdrew from the cities last summer, you do get a sense of how big of an operation this is and how many weeks and months it is going to go on. The American military began withdrawing months ago. These numbers have come down gradually. I believe the number is in the high 60,000 right now. It'll be 50,000 by the end of August. it's supposedly going to be at zero by the end of next year. But again, diplomats and even Iraqi officials are saying that agreement may be renegotiated. So, but you're exactly right. It's a vast logistical exercise, but one that is oddly, I think, you know, beyond the eyes of most Iraqis.
So the several thousand troops, U.S. troops, that will remain in Iraq for, what, 16 months or so, what will their mission be?
Well, their mission is supposed to be training, advising. But, again, these are terms that are elastic. And I have to stress that word. You know, you can call something, you know, training and advising, and then you can do something else when it comes to, you know, being on the ground. You know, there's a notion right now that all military action is taking place with joint patrols, but you know, the fact is that you still have American soldiers fighting in parts of the country. You still have them patrolling with a token Iraqi presence in Baghdad. You still have them fighting up north around Mosul. So again, these terms, we have to be careful how much we read into these terms, because they are often manipulated. They're often elastic. They're often, you know, having more of a political purpose than a practical effect.
From politics to security, I mean, the picture you paint doesn't sound terribly encouraging. Is Iraq ready, to your mind, for the U.S. to go?
Well, I guess it depends on what ready means. You know, will it be more ready if the Americans stay longer? That's a question I think you could ask, and I'm not sure what the answer is to that. It is a somewhat dysfunctional country right now. It's a political process that's stalemated. Basic services are still not being delivered to Iraqis, or at least to the level that Iraqis had hoped for or wanted to be delivered. There's not a lot of hope out there about what's ahead. So when the Americans leave, or if we describe this as the American departure after 7 years here, there's definitely a mixed legacy in the country itself. It's a country that, like I said earlier, is anxious, is uneasy, and there are concerns about what's ahead.
Well, Anthony Shadid, thank you very much for your time. Anthony's a reporter for The New York Times. He joined me from Baghdad. Anthony, thanks.
My pleasure.
Joining me now from Junction City, Kansas, near Fort Riley, is David Finkel, Pulitzer Prize-winning staff writer and National Enterprise reporter for The Washington Post. His book, The Good Soldiers, is out in paperback today. He was embedded in Iraq during 2007 and 2008. David, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
And from the NPR studios in New York City is Matt Gallagher, a former Army captain who served from 2007 to 2009. He also blogged from Iraq during his tour. His new book is Kaboom. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
David Finkel, I'll begin with you. You are talking to soldiers right now at Fort Riley who are just returning from Iraq. How are they responding to the president's announcement of a pull-down in troops?
Well, it was interesting late last night to get online and read the words that President Obama spoke yesterday in Atlanta. The ones that stood out to me most of all, beyond his announcement of the timetable for the drawdown, was a quiet promise toward the end when he said, at the same time, every American who has ever worn the uniform must also know this: your country is going to take care of you when you come home. It was a poignant sentence for me, because while he was giving his speech in Atlanta, I was watching a welcome home ceremony on Fort Riley for the very latest soldiers to come out of Iraq. And it was a gym full of probably a couple of hundred people, family members, a lot of flags, a lot of tears, a lot of cheering as the soldiers walked in. But mixed in were the soldiers I got to know during the surge. And one in particular was a guy who in June 2007 was in a Humvee that was hit by a roadside bomb. He bled out of his ears for a while. He's still having trouble hearing. He has TBI. He has PTSD. And he's emblematic of what was scattered throughout that gym, and I think what is scattered across the country. It's a continuing war for a lot of soldiers. Even as it may be drawing down in Iraq, it seems to be moving into America.
Mm. Matt Gallagher, is a former Army captain yourself who served in Iraq, I'm curious what your reaction, as you hear David Finkel speak from your own experience, what's your reaction to President Obama's announcement of this formal conclusion of the combat mission in Iraq?
Well, kind of like David mentioned, it's the war that we're going to be bringing home as soldiers return, and kind of that ambiguity that even Anthony mentioned earlier is something that all veterans, you know, kind of carry. You go into that, and it's so atypical of what the typical American viewpoint of war is. You go in and you expect to have some kind of clear enemy and clear mission, and you can find it from a day-to-day perspective, but the murkiness from a grand picture is always there. And that's something that I think America, through its veterans, is going to be dealing with for a long time.
Hmm. Matt, what kind of Iraq did America build, and what kind of Iraq is America leaving?
Well, I got there in late 2007, so the Iraq I found was probably far different than the one in 2003 and 2004. I can say that the Iraq we left in 2009 was a safer, more secure place, slightly more built up than the one we found. But, you know, the million-dollar question is that sustainable or not? If anybody knew the answer to that question, we wouldn't be in the stalemate right now.
The sustainability of that security, David Finkel, obviously a key question. I mean, what's your answer to that? What kind of Iraq did America build, and what kind of Iraq is America leaving?
Where I spent a year during the surge was in East Baghdad. It was a really rough area that at the beginning when the soldiers I was writing about, when they landed in East Baghdad, it was pretty much out of control. This was at the beginning of the counterinsurgency strategy known as the surge. You know, by the time they left 15 months later, in many ways, things were a little bit calmer, not entirely. But during that year, during that 15 months the soldiers were on the ground, it was such a violent place. To watch soldiers in this battalion, the average age 19, most on their first deployment, go from eager soldiers in the beginning, thinking they were invincible, to a somewhat mentally and physically degraded force at the end by the time they came home, no longer really believing in this thing called a mission, but just there, as seems to happen in any war, because of the guy next to them. It does raise questions about what happened during that time and what the lasting effects are going to be.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're hearing stories about the Iraq War as U.S. troops are leaving in big numbers now. Yesterday, President Obama addressed the Disabled American Veterans Group in Atlanta. He spoke about transitioning the U.S. military commitment in Iraq from combat to supporting and training Iraqi security forces.
The hard truth is we have not seen the end of American sacrifice in Iraq. But make no mistake, our commitment in Iraq is changing from a military effort led by our troops to a civilian effort led by our diplomats. And as we mark the end of America's combat mission in Iraq, a grateful America must pay tribute to all who served there.
I'm joined today by David Finkel, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post and author of a tremendous account of the war in Iraq, The Good Soldiers, and by Matt Gallagher, Iraq War veteran and author of the new book, Kaboom. Matt, we heard David Finkel speak before the break of this sort of very idealistic views of the soldiers, U.S. soldiers, these views that they had as they went into Iraq, what they could accomplish, and then what happened to them over the course of their deployments. How did you view Iraq and the Iraqis as you got to Iraq, and how did that change for you?
Yeah. What David mentioned is very accurate. We were there 15 months, and you show up full of energy, ready to get the job done. It's all very vague, of course. And over the course of time, as it evolves, the wear and tear just breaks you down. It's just not even the big events like firefights or IEDs or when you lose comrades. It's the day-to-day grind of counterinsurgency, and you're constantly questioning, what you're accomplishing, how much you're doing, etc. There are high points. Occasionally a school is opened or a water treatment facility or what have you. But most of the time, you find yourself really, really struggling to find a sense of purpose.
David Finkel, you describe American soldiers and their complicated relationship with the Iraqis over this last 7 years. Did Iraqis ever trust the American troops? Did they ever welcome them in your reporting?
It was a difficult time. I covered the beginning of the war for the Washington Post. I was not embedded. I just kind of ran around Iraq on my own. And it was such a different war then than the one I came back to. during the surge. And at that point, even if an Iraqi wanted to trust an American, it was so difficult because the Americans would at least in East Baghdad, would roll into a neighborhood in a convoy of four or five or more Humvees. They would get out of Humvees, and they were heavily armored, not only in terms of the weapons they had, but just the gear they were wearing, 60 pounds of gear, body armor and the rest of it, and they would move through neighborhoods trying to build goodwill with Iraqis who might talk to an American for a few minutes, but any longer than that, there was one guy, I remember, who just began, he got so nervous, and he was sweating so badly the longer the troops stayed, because he understood that as soon as the Americans left, he was going to be swarmed by people saying, why did you talk to the Americans for so long? What did you say? So it was a very, very difficult time.
Mac Gallagher, to your mind, how did we achieve some level of success in Iraq?
Well, the ugly answer to that is money. Part of the counterinsurgency strategy was imbuing the local economy and, hiring local sheikhs or power brokers to take charge of the Sons of Iraq program. Some of the Iraqis that I never had trouble talking to were these sheikhs and power brokers. Sometimes it was funny. You'd show up and they were 65-year-old men watching Suzanne Summers workout videos. But most of the time, it was straight business. By the time we left in early 2009, the Iraqis, we were handing over responsibility of paying that Sons of Iraq irregular program to the Iraqi government. And there was a lot of concern amongst the local populace that once the American money was taken away, that the civil unrest that we had worked so hard to quell during the surge would return.
David Finkel, how would you answer that question about how we achieved some level of success in Iraq?
It might have come after the surge. You know, first of all, there's a lot of discussion about how much the surge mattered in the reduction of violence, and it seems to me that it's simply too soon to know whether it was the addition of 30,000 troops in that big country, whether it was a counterinsurgency strategy, whether it was what was happening with the Anbar awakening and some of the payments that Matt was describing. You know, it's probably all those things. It's just, I guess, some historian someday will assign the proper proportions. But by the time this battalion I was embedded with left, you know, they thought they had made somewhat of a difference by the end of their deployment. But as they were packing up to go home, the area they had just exploded all of a sudden into the very worst violence they had been through in the entire 15-month deployment. I mean, for the last 10 days, instead of packing to go home, they were just in a flat-out war, day and night. And there were just too many incidents, too many explosions, roadside bombs, gunfights to really keep track of. And one of the great demoralizing things was right at the very end, a roadside bomb was perfectly aimed and went into a Humvee. A lot of soldiers hurt, two dead, and that was a breaking point, I think, for a lot of the soldiers. They came home really confused about what exactly they had accomplished. Hmm.
Do you have a sense of what you accomplished, Matt?
Yes, but I'm keenly aware that you're so married to the experience that you lose any sense of objectivity. You know, you pour your blood, sweat, and tears into something for 15 months. You don't want to think that what you've accomplished perhaps isn't as big as you thought it was, or perhaps it's only a fleeting thing. Like I referenced earlier, probably the highlight of my deployment was watching a new school get built and having it be a peaceful day for all involved. There is this looming sense of lost cause that I still feel, and it's why all veterans remain interested in, well, most veterans, I don't want to speak for all, but you you remain so interested in what's going on over there because of your own time there, even though the wars from year to year differ so much.
So with 4,400 members more of the U.S. military having died since the invasion and nearly 32,000 having been wounded, for those who have sacrificed and served, what do they want? I mean, what do they want for Iraq?
I don't think there's a universal answer to that. Soldiers join for a litany of reasons and get out of their service just as much. I would say, however, that I think America needs to be keenly aware that veterans care is something that isn't just going to take 4 or 5 years. These traumatic brain injuries and PTSD cases, in addition to the numerous burn injuries, etc., this is something that the country is going to be dealing with for the next 40, 50 years, and it's going to be expensive. And I don't think the greater society is really aware that this is going to happen. You accumulate a fair amount of veterans over the course of 9, 10 years.
Let's go to the phones. So many listeners have called to join you both in this conversation. Nashville, Tennessee is where we find Mike. Hi, Mike. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I served in Iraq during the invasion and then again right before the surge with the 101st Airborne. It is a deeply emotional subject for me that I don't talk about a ton, but I felt compelled to call because as I look for perspective on what the experience of those 2 years and my friends who died means to me, I guess it's just that, really, no matter what turns out historically, you know, we just fought for each other. And I guess that endures in my mind. No matter what happens, is we were really just over there trying to get each other home.
Mike, thank you very much for calling. And thanks for your service, sir. David Frankel, will you tell the story that you write in your book? Having listened to Mike's call, so much of what happens in Iraq, what happened there, you know, we don't know about. You chronicle it in your book. Tell us the story of when David Petraeus visited a remote outpost in Iraq that few other officials had visited. It's a very telling story because it shows how even those at the top of the army didn't really see everything that the soldiers were going through and sometimes heard good news, but not all the bad news.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'd like to say thanks to Mike for even calling. A good thing for him to do. And I know from getting emails from so many soldiers since my book has come out, just how difficult it is for them to talk to anyone about what they've been through. The story you've asked about was, there were just so many extreme, extraordinary days in East Baghdad. And this happened to be a day in September 2007, right after David Petraeus had come to Washington. And there was a huge event when he first testified about how the surge was going. And he left Washington, went back to Iraq, and just happened to visit the forward operating base in East Baghdad, where I was. He basically came to get a report from the soldiers I was embedded with. And, you know, there weren't many... they weren't all bad days, but there weren't a lot of great days either. And this happened to be a great day for this battalion because the battalion commander had never before briefed a four-star, and in came one of the most famous men in the world at that point. And as the battalion commander was telling him about one of the initiatives they had done, which simply involved putting a platoon of soldiers at a gas station, and by doing that, two-day waits for gasoline were down to an hour. A source of funding for roadside bombs was drying up. As they were describing this, Petraeus interrupted him and said, we know about this, and we need to do more of it in Iraq. And it was, and you could it was almost like sunbeams coming off the battalion commander when Petraeus said this. And Petraeus left, and a couple hours later, the battalion commander was outside just still talking about how great that was when there was an explosion, and it was a huge explosion. And then A couple seconds later came a black coil of smoke into the air, and it was coming from the fuel station. And it just so happened that the platoon leaving that day, there was another roadside bomb. It went into a Humvee. It went into a soldier named Joshua Reeves. And 1 minute, the battalion commander was talking about how wonderful this day was, and the next minute he was down at the aid station just watching a shredded soldier dying in front of his eyes. That's kind of how it went over there every day. I'm sure Matt understands this as well as anybody.
It's probably scenes that you remember well, Matt.
Yes, you know, they linger with you. But, you know, as Mike said, you know the emotion is very telling in his voice. You lose the big side of the big picture when you're over there, and you do just rely on your fellow soldiers to get through. You know, you want to accomplish the mission as honorably as possible, as murky a phrase as that may be. But you know, the primary thing is just getting home, it's something that Mike spoke very well on it.
Here's Jason from Houston, Texas. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I was with the 4th Infantry back in 2003, and I went to Iraq from 2003 to 2004. And I think the point needs to be brought up is, you know, our division, you know, we captured Saddam, and, you know, the way I feel about it is, the reason we went over there, the primary mission was to take Saddam out of power, you know, and the name of the war is Iraqi freedom, and, you know, and that's what we did. We got Saddam, and, you know, we gave the Iraqis their freedom. I think it's time, you know, we've given enough sacrifice, you know, I think it's time for American men and women to quit dying, and it's time for Iraq to pick up the pieces. You know, our mission wasn't to go over there and rebuild their country. You know, our mission was to give them their freedom, and that's what we've done. And it's time for them to police up themselves, I think. And you know, I'm tired of seeing men and women, you know, from America die in Iraq when really the Iraqis should be doing something for themselves, I think.
Jason, thank you. David Finkel, there's Jason saying it's time to step up. We heard Anthony Shadid at the top of the program saying, you know what? It's going to be hard, and there's a political stalemate in Iraq. The political system remains wobbly 5 months after elections. Politicians are still struggling to form a new government. We read today one of the legislators was assassinated. I mean, the insurgency is growing. Services are poor. I mean, what's the impact of the American withdrawal, generally speaking, in Iraq now?
Well, nobody. I don't know of anybody who can speak to it. A journalist who can speak to it better than Anthony Shadid. I just take it as blanket fact what he was describing at the beginning of the program. It seems to me from conversations I have with soldiers over there, with journalists over there, and with friends who are there, the place remains a mess if you're an Iraqi. It's not much electricity. It's not a peaceful place in any way. Explosions keep going off. There's no political system to rely on. There's not really rule of law yet. So there's so many ways to look at what Iraq is at this point. But from the Iraqi perspective, it certainly isn't a country that is at the top of the charts for livability right now.
Matt Gallagher, would you agree?
I would. You know, there was a sense even when I was there that, you know, if you break it, you buy it, and that's, you know, in my mind, why we were still there, and, you know, last-ditch effort employed the switch to counterinsurgency strategy to try to bring some stability back to Iraq. You know, freedom and democracy are wonderful things, but if you don't have a stable country and stable environment to enjoy those things, then they're really kind of pointless.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're hearing stories this hour about the Iraq War as U.S. troops are drawn down there. I'm joined today by David Finkel, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post and author of The Good Soldiers, and by Matt Gallagher, Iraq War veteran and author of the new book, Kaboom. Yesterday at the Disabled American Veterans Conference in Atlanta, President Obama said that soldiers suffering from PTSD should not suffer in silence, that they need to reach out for help.
We're making major investments in awareness, outreach, and suicide prevention, hiring more mental health professionals, improving care and treatment. For those of you suffering from PTSD, we're making it a whole lot easier to qualify for VA benefits. From now on, if a VA doctor confirms a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, that is enough, no matter what war you served in.
David Finkel, can you talk about that particular problem that strikes so many soldiers who have come home, and about really the transition from Iraq to the United States, what happens to these soldiers when they get here?
Well, I'd like to talk about one soldier in particular who I'm spending a lot of time with here in Kansas. He was just acknowledged as one of the very, very best soldiers in this battalion of 800 infantry soldiers, a guy named Adam Schumann. He was on his third deployment when I caught up with him. And when Jason before was talking about the initial invasion, Adam Schumann was there for that. He was there a couple of years later. And then he was there for the surge. And there came a day soon after these guys got there. There was an operation to try to bring a particularly chaotic area under control. And a soldier was on a rooftop, and a sniper got a clean shot into the back of his head, and the soldier went down. He didn't die, but he was grievously injured. And they couldn't quite get him down the stairs, so Adam Schumann finally picked him up in kind of a modified fireman's carry and took him down three flights of stairs so he could be medevaced out. Well, it just so happened because of the angle of things that much of the blood coming out of this soldier's head kept going into Adam Schumann's mouth, and he kept spitting it out and spitting it out. And 6 months later, he was still tasting the guy's blood, and the time came for him to go home. He just couldn't do it anymore. You know, one of the bravest things Adam Schumann did was to walk into combat stress and ask for help. That resulted in him being sent home, and he went home feeling terribly guilty for abandoning his men. It's a few years later. He continues to be overwhelmed by guilt, and he's been diagnosed with PTSD, with TBI, with all kinds of things. And look, the fact is that this guy's fighting the war every day. I know this because I talk to him all the time. I've been with Schumann on his very worst days when he was considering suicide, some of his best days, but there's no clear road ahead for him. And forgive me for using one guy and suggesting he's emblematic of a larger problem, but I think he is, and I think there is a larger problem, and it remains to be seen beyond Obama's words yesterday how true the commitment will be to helping these guys out.
Matt Gallagher, are your comrades able to talk about what happened? Is it more acceptable to experience PTSD or other issues after coming home from Iraq?
A bit. You know, it was easier for me than most. I had every support system possible, and I also was transitioning out of the military. For a lot of guys who remain in, they don't have time really to come to terms with their experiences. One of my staff sergeants, Chris Mason, he's 28 years old, and he just recently deployed for the fourth time. That's upwards of almost 55 months he has spent in combat in the last 6 years. So obviously, you know, he's just one example of the many burdens being carried by very few when you compare it to American society in general. So there's going to be a cumulative effect of this, and it's not just the political leaders that need to be aware of this and help transitioning veterans. I really think that most of America hasn't really been asked to participate or contribute to these war efforts, and if they really want to give back, you know, getting involved in some of these veteran organizations like Wounded Warrior Project or Soldiers Angels, that's the way to show it.
David Finkel, talk about those deployments, the grueling pace of deployments that Matt refers to. How did that impact this war?
Well, I can tell you how it impacted the soldiers I was with at that particular time. You know, before I was describing again how eager they were to get there and how invincible they felt, and then they had their first KIA, and then a second, and then a third, and the realization came that, well, it turns out they aren't invincible, and so you'd see these 19 and 20 year old kids making these, you know, just extraordinary calculations in a particular day, and they were small things, but sometimes the small things say so much. So here would these guys would go out yet again into an area seeded with so many roadside bombs. Look, they got a lot of the bombs. They found them, but they couldn't find them all. And so out they would go every day. They would get into their Humvees, and you would see these soldiers deciding to sit with one foot in front of another. So perhaps if a bomb blew, they would lose one foot instead of both feet. They would tie horseshoes to the grills of their Humvees. They would ride along with their hands tucked behind their body armor, so maybe they wouldn't lose their hands. They were ferociously funny kids, and sometimes they would just have contests about what their last words ought to be. And you know, it was funny at the time, but in hindsight, the farther away I get from it and think back to what these kids were going through, how in the world can it not have a lasting effect?
Here's Sharon. She's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hi, Sharon. Thank you for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi. This is the first time I've listened to your program, and I think it's tremendous. You're talking about the war effort and all these men that have sacrificed their lives. These are young men coming from all across the country, and I think we should support them. And I'm a social worker, and my sister's a therapist, and she was asked if she could, you know, be one of the therapists to help talk with the men. And her caseload was full, but I was thinking that maybe we could set up support groups, because if these men don't want to talk about things, maybe they would want to talk with other men that went through the same thing in like a support group. So I've come from a generation of a family of three generations of wars. My dad was in World War II, my uncle was in the Korean War, and my brother was supposed to go to Vietnam. And I'm kind of ashamed of my brother because he did not go to Vietnam. My dad was a doctor, and he wrote a letter for him to get out of the war, which I think was terrible. I remember when I was younger, my dad wanted me to go in the service because I got out of high school and I was acting up and partying. But
well, I know there are so many men and women who have served and who hear your message, Sharon, about resources, and will appreciate that. Let's go to Sharon now from Burlington, Vermont. Sharon, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello. My son is a Marine, and he was in Iraq twice. And I think everyone should know, although Matthew, who called, said it best, that the family also feels the loss of, I feel the loss of my son's losses. I lost a piece of him over there that I will never get back. And he's 26, and he has PTSD, and he's a functioning member of society, as hard as it is for him behind the scenes. And I will forever be saddened for the 2 years that that I wasn't with him, and he went through unspeakable things that he will never be able to share with us. So,
Sharon, thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for raising a son that would be brave and go serve our country. Thank you. David Finkel, let me ask you, Sharon's comment reminds me of a story that you tell in your book, Lee Crookston and her son Duncan Crookston, the impact on the families. This is a young man who left Iraq with no arms and no legs. I'd like you to describe his story.
Well, it was this comes back to a day, September 4th, 2007, and if there was ever a day that shows how any war is really two wars, the one being fought in Washington, the one being fought on the ground in whatever country the war is occurring in, that day is a pretty good example. It was the day that George W. Bush landed in Australia and was asked how the war was going, And the president's answer that day was, we're kicking ass. And that was his authentic answer. And I don't quarrel with that. That's how we thought that the war was going on September 4th. In East Baghdad, it was the day of another roadside bomb into a Humvee with this battalion I was with, and three soldiers died. The fourth lost both of his legs. And the fifth was Duncan Crookston, 19 years old. And he lost both of his legs all the way up. He lost his right arm. He lost most of his left arm. What was left of him was very badly burned. But he didn't die. He was airlifted first to Germany and then to San Antonio, Texas. And, you know, the months went by. He underwent 30 surgeries. His ears fell off, tip of his nose fell off, eyebrows gone, eyelashes, eyelids. He spent month after month basically bolted to a bed, wrapped in bandages, being tended to by his young wife and his mother, Lee. And then he died, and he left behind his wife, and he left behind a mother who wrote a letter right after he died announcing his death, in which she said, Duncan would have been 20 years old tomorrow. He'll be forever 19 now and forever missed. And of all the lines in my book, I think that may be the best line of all, the one she wrote.
Here's Larry calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Larry. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. I'd like to make this point without in any way insulting the soldiers that have served, for the most part, honorably in Iraq. But, and you began to address this question a little bit before the break at the half hour, but at the beginning of the show, you were talking about how Iraq was, you know, before the surge and after the surge, but we really need to go back and look at how Iraq was before we invaded and how we leave it now. And I do agree that it is right for us to leave because we're not making the situation better. But we as a nation need to learn a whole lot more humility. We invaded a country under false pretenses. We didn't care for the leadership of that country, and I don't want to be defending Saddam Hussein, but it was a functioning country, and it's not really a functioning country at this point as we leave it. And, you know, we really do need to learn from this because I don't think we learned from Vietnam, and we don't want to keep repeating this mistake.
Larry, thank you. Matt Gallagher, how would you respond?
Yeah, no, I think he's spot on. You go back to 2003, you know, going to war is what soldiers do. These terrible personal tragedies have occurred since humanity discovered war. And if the political leaders determine that we as the military need to invade Antarctica in flippers, we'll do so. I don't mean to be flippant about that, but you know we do as told. Simultaneously, though, you know, the civilians are the ones who are in charge of the politicians. And you go back to 2003, and there was some kind of disconnect. There was some kind of failure in the system that led to the Iraq invasion, in my opinion. I don't know if it was lack of engagement, lack of personal or vested interest, and an unforeseen byproduct of the all-volunteer force, but something went wrong. And I do hope that we as a society and as individuals look back in that and actually learn from it.
David Finkel, is there one moment, one story you'll forever remember from your extensive reporting in Iraq as we draw down troops there on this day?
I remember the whole thing. I remember every bit of it. I was on the ground for 8 months as an observer, and it's a cumulative thing. It's the thing, I guess the broad thing I think about every day is how war does what war has always done. It's it basically degrades everybody involved. The Iraqis, the Americans, just in this war, top to bottom. Whatever your political viewpoint is, the fact is what happened on the ground was day by day. It was a combination of utter decency in the face of the very worst moments imaginable, and it was also about kind of degradation of the soul. The fact that the soldiers kept functioning every day, doing it well, in my opinion, trying hard for something that became more and more difficult for them to understand. That's what I think about.
Matt Gallagher, you're a soldier. You served with honor in Iraq. One listener wonders, was Iraq worth it? Was the Iraq War worth it to you?
Oh, man. That's quite a question. To me personally, I'm glad I served. My best friends in the world are the fellow soldiers I went over there with. One caller earlier mentioned a support group. Sometimes just getting together with a couple other veterans at the bar is the best therapy that there is for me. But what lingers the most is definitely the Iraqi children. They linger for me the most.
Well, I am very grateful to both of you for a really insightful and moving hour. David Finkel, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post. His book, The Good Soldiers, is out in paperback today. David, it's an extraordinary work. Thank you for that and for your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
And Matt Gallagher is an Iraq War veteran and author of the new book, Kaboom, based on his combat experiences and blog reports from the field. Matt, thank you for your service, sir.
Thank you for having me, Jane. I appreciate it.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.